Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles with me, Jack Pelling.
Welcome to Slaggers. It's me, Robin Allender.
We've got a fantastic episode coming up with John Bradley, who is a brilliant actor and massive Beatles fan, who you will probably know from the HBO fantasy epic Game of Thrones. Robin, you're a big throny.
Yeah, I love a bit of Thrones. Yes, I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, and it was great how we did this whole interview, and we only really touched on Game of Thrones in one section, really. He's so keen to talk about the Beatles. It's not like he doesn't mind talking about Game of Thrones, but it's like, it was just kind of really nice. He's so nice, he's so down to earth and just eager to chat.
He's an absolutely lovely guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, he's got fantastic Beatles knowledge and some really good insight into them. So we chat a lot about his sort of formative experience and what Beatles fandom kind of means and how it's evolved over the years. And then we do talk a little bit about, you know, listening to the Beatles on set with Game of Thrones, with fellow castmates who also got into the band and challenge each other's knowledge and stuff. So
And there's quite an interesting segue where we have to, like, John's way into the Beatles, weirdly, was Paul is Dead. Not that he actually believed it, but that he just got so into the theory. So there's quite a long departure there.
Yeah, he also came up with his very own piece of hidden Beatles messaging as
well. Which I could see when he held up the vinyl records, which obviously you won't be able to see on the podcast. But I could see that what he explains, and I can't see it anymore.
I couldn't see it, I must say. Yeah. But we'll go on, if you go to our Instagram at Personal Beatles, I'll post a little picture of what apparently is a very mysterious secret message about Paul's death, apparently.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a very funny chat.
It was great.
And it was an absolutely superb episode. Yeah. So stand by and enjoy that one.
Mm.
What have you got for us this week, Robin?
Well, a couple of things. Talked a bit about the Beatles chord changes in the intro to last week's episode.
Mm-hmm.
And someone very rightly pointed out Penny Lane has got one of the best chord changes in pop music history in it, which is which passed me by. But yeah, that's, of course, Penny Lane.
Are you talking about the sort of that little progression into the chorus? Or because there is also exactly what I said there wasn't, which is a cheesy semitone.
Yeah, it's a semitone modulation, isn't it? Yeah. But it's, I mean, it works so fluently in the song. You don't really think, you don't picture like Backstreet Boys getting up from their stools when he does that on Penny Lane. You know, it's a very different kind of key change. Yeah. But yeah, thanks for that. What's the other thing I was going to say? Oh, yeah. I just remembered in the Matthew... Sorry, this sounds so stupid. During the Matthew Crosby one, we were talking about Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
And I said, you can see the Terry Gilliam influence. It's the other way around. I'm such an idiot. Obviously, Yellow Submarine influenced Terry Gilliam.
Right,
You just wake up in the night worrying about these things.
I think the statute of limitations for podcast errors is, let's say, if it's 6 months ago, we can move
on. I'm a very anxious man, Jack. I need to resolve these things.
I don't think many people would have unsubscribed over that.
Good to clear it up. The other thing I was going to talk about was, we've got a really fun episode coming up next week. Which, should we say who it is now?
We usually save it to the end.
It's Joe Wisby, who runs the Beatles Books podcast. And we've got we're going to record a chat with him this week, which will go out next week. And I'm really looking forward to that. And as part of the research for that, I've been making my way through Steve Turner's Beatles 66 Revolutionary Year, which is absolutely brilliant. I could heartily recommend it. Because I think what's good about it is it kind of, and we'll talk about this in the podcast, but it kind of slows down the timeline. So by focusing on one year, he can go into so much more detail about basically how the Beatles got from Help in 65 to Pepper in 67, you know, like that extraordinary transformation that happened in 66. But there's a great bit in there which he kind of goes into a lot of detail about when the first time they would have taken acid would be and the resulting songs. And do you think of Help as an acid song?
No. I think of that as the sort of Fat Elvis period.
Fat Elvis,
really.
Or Pot, as they would have called it, a pot song. But like, being, I think it's
posted.
Yeah. But I think there is an argument it's an acid song, and that when he talks about opening up the door, is it a reference to Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception?
I mean, probably not.
It could be. I think it is.
It could be.
But there's a, but yeah, it made me,
you might say.
It made me go back to, have you read Doors of Perception?
No, I haven't.
It's really good because it's almost inadvertently hilarious. Because it's a very intelligent man talking about what happens when you take mescaline. But you could read it in the voice of Otto from The Simpsons. And it's basically someone telling you the most long-winded drug story you've ever heard. But it's so good. And it is brilliant. And you can definitely see the link to Beatles stuff. He talks about Tibetan Book of the Dead and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But there's a great bit where he talks about... He basically is very high on mescaline. And he goes to this shop and he goes to the section of art books and he picks up a Botticelli book and he's looking at the pictures and he suddenly realizes that the whole history of visual art is the kind of history of how people painted clothes. it sounds like something someone would say in the Black Swan in Bristol. Very niche reference there, but he said, this is so good. He says, draperies, as I had now discovered, are much more than devices for the introduction of non-representational forms into naturalistic paintings and sculptures. What the rest of us see only under the influence of mescaline, the artist is congenitally equipped to see all the time. His perception is not limited to what is biologically or socially useful. A little of the knowledge belonging to mind at large oozes past the reducing valve of brain and ego into his consciousness. It is a knowledge of the intrinsic significance of every existent. For the artist, as for the mescaline taker, draperies are living hieroglyphs that stand in some peculiarly expressive way for the unfathomable mystery of pure being. This is how one ought to see, I kept saying, as I looked down at my trousers. It's so good.
Won't you please help me?
Yeah, please help me. I'm very high and I'm fascinated by my trousers. I mean... That is really interesting, and again, it's something I'm sure we'll talk about when we're talking about Beatles 66. But the way drugs did open those doors of perception.
So we'll be chatting about that book and many more in Joe's collection of over 400 Beatles books, which is extraordinary. On next week's podcast.
But for now, here are John Bradley's personal Beatles.
Welcome to the podcast, John Bradley.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on. How lovely.
Hello.
Very nice to see you. Thanks very much for doing it.
Yeah. Not at all. Any excuse. Any excuse to talk about the Beatles. My girlfriend puts up with it most of the time. She can't wait for me to talk to somebody else about it. Gives her a bit of a rest for a while. So it works well for everybody.
Where do you sit on the sort of Beatles fandom scale? Would you describe yourself as a super fan or a Beatles nerd or a...
It's interesting, really, isn't it, that you can call yourself a super fan and then you start talking to a real super fan and you realise that you're,
yes.
you're sort of mid-table, maybe battling relegation.
Yeah.
At best sometimes. Like, I thought I was a super fan, and then you meet people like the brilliant Jeff Lloyd. And Jeff Lloyd goes beyond super fan into sort of scholar almost, like Beatles professor, and you realise that you sort of got a long way to go till you get to that level. But no, I think I can hold my own. I feel very comfortable with my sort of Beatles, the level of my Beatles fandom. It's a bit of a strange one though, isn't it, that like people seem to want to challenge you on it a lot. Like I remember when I was doing Game of Thrones, we used to play this game where you have to identify the Beatles song via the first word of the lyrics. So it's quite a tough game to play. And I overheard one of our producers, Brian, talking about it with our director.
Yeah.
And they were talking about it and I sort of joined in. But there was a sense at first of, this fella thinks he can sort of join in with this game. You know what I mean? Bless him. Bless his heart. Yeah. I think you always feel that you have to justify the intensity of your fandom, you know?
I know exactly what you mean. And if in case you're... I mean, you mentioned this in the Egg Pod as well, so if you're going to do the question that was asked, I would have got it probably because you mentioned it in the Egg Pod. But the question was without. Could you get that one, Jack? Without.
What, a Beatles song that begins with without.
Which Beatles song begins with the word without?
I mean... I was just about to say that I'm absolutely useless. once we in a pre-recorded section, I tried to. We were talking about like the game of doing track listings of Beatles albums,
which is surprisingly hard.
Absolutely fucking terrible. Like, even albums that I know every single second of, I can't. As soon as you ask me anything like that, I'm absolutely useless.
Yeah. So put us out of our misery, John. What's without?
It's The Inner Light, of course.
Yeah.
Without great going song, out of my door. I mean, it's funny you should say that, isn't it, about track listings and stuff. I think that I can imagine. I've got this sort of thing about, do sort of Johnny Come Lately Beatles fans like myself and you guys, do we sort of think about them differently, the way that people of our parents' generation who lived through it and, you know, that was part of their youth culture and they went on that journey with them.
Yeah.
Do we sort of see it a bit differently? Because I imagine that that because they bought their Beatles albums in a physical form and they put the record on and probably played the record start to finish, I sort of imagine that they do better at the sort of track listing game than we would, I think.
I think so. And I think there's also a thing of, like, my dad, who obviously grew up at that time, would come out with things which nowadays you'd think were probably quite Beatles scholarly. You know, like what I mean? But because you absorb it in the culture then. Like, he had a thing, I remember he said once, which I think I just, recited on this podcast without really thinking about it, but my dad once said Ringo was the only really working-class Beatle. I was like, where did you get that from? And it's really, like, quite a controversial take.
Yeah.
You know? Mm. But, like, my dad just, where did he get this kind of osmosis kind of cultural knowledge coming from, you know? Well, it was just, I think if you lived through it, you kind of absorbed a lot of the different factors and heard the different voices and saw the way they interacted and stuff, you know?
And do you reckon that's also something to do with the fact that back then you were sort of divided on party lines by who your favourite was?
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that we saw, I mean, the John and Paul debate is always a big debate and we'll probably touch upon that later on, but yeah. I just think that the further they go in the rear view mirror, the more that our generation sees them as sort of perfect and untouchable and sort of behind glass almost, because for the majority, if not the entirety, of my career as a Beatles fan, half of them haven't been alive.
Yeah.
So it feels like they've gone and they've left this incredibly perfect, strong body of work. And I imagine that when people were living through it and the new Beatles single came out and it was more everyday to them. Like, I imagine that the Beatles' new single had come out and it'd be a big case of, have you heard the Beatles' new single? Yeah, I don't like it as much as the last one.
Yeah.
Really. You know what I mean? I just think that they're not sort of canonised and eulogised by that generation in a funny way as much as it is with ours, because there's something historically significant about them now, and I think that adds a weight to it. For example, you know, my mum and dad, they were very sort of musically and culturally active in the 60s and they love the Beatles, but they're not necessarily their out and out favorite band the way that you'd expect them to be, with them being the best band of the time.
Yeah.
But it's more nuanced than that. It's not just like their favourite bands may be the Who, the Stones, the Kinks. You'd think it'd be the Beatles just because objectively they are the best, but it's a bit more, it's a bit different for that generation.
Well, they're just so much part of the fabric, wasn't it? I think I remember reading, there's a David Lodge book written in the 60s called The British Museum is Falling Down.
Right.
Mm. And one of the plot points is that the guy can't get to the British Museum because the Beatles are in town, kind of Hard Day's Night era.
Right.
And so all the traffic's blocked. But that's like just a sub plot thing. It's like, that's the interesting bit. You see what the Beatles are up to. But like, it's just, it obviously just included it because it was just part of the fabric of the kind of culture that was going on there. It wasn't even surprising.
Exactly. But isn't that a sort of interesting, I mean, I don't know when that book was written, but looking back on that, that's such interesting symbolism that, that then it would be seen that this pop band are getting in the way of me seeing this culture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then as time went on, they became part of that culture.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
What's that book called?
It's called The British Museum is Falling Down.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. I might look into that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. 1965. So it's actually published 65, so yeah.
Oh, well, that's
very much in the...
Yeah, so that sort of... That symbolism... isn't sort of built into it. It's only retrospectively that we can look and see the symbolism of that.
Yeah, yeah,
that,
yeah.
That sort of contrast between the two, one high culture and one low culture.
And and now Beatles lyrics are in the British Museum or British Library. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, the story definitely seems to be becoming more alluring and, you know, there's definitely certainly an appetite for just more and more sort of Beatles stuff coming out, you know, whether it's documentaries or whatever. Like, I mean, that as the story becomes more and more sort of, you know, hailed in this grand mythic terms, then I suppose you also have the luxury of being able to pick and choose the stuff that you want to listen to in the immediacy as well. So if you don't, I mean, I can't imagine a Beatles album coming out and me being disappointed with it. But when you get to dip into it in any way you want, that's a nice luxury to have 50 years on.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the what's so interesting about that and what John, I think, you know, you're saying as well, is that kind of idea that we have kind of put it behind glass now and it's kind of canonized, but so much of it is kind of what makes it great are those imperfections and things. And, you know, is it like, you know, I like this story. James Joyce was proofreading Ulysses because there's loads of mistakes and he couldn't be bothered to finish proofreading it. So it's like only did about 200 pages of it. So there is no definitive Ulysses because it was always a work in progress. And like, I think that's really interesting in terms of the way, say, Let It Be, Get Back is it's canon. Canonicity, for want of another word, is really problematic because it was this kind of unfinished artifact, you know, and it is like literally like incomplete. It's like problematic. There are different versions, there are different takes, there are different mixes, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think that's a kind of interesting thing with the legacy, isn't it? You know,
but the Mozart Requiem is exactly the same if people don't go on about, you know, his original...
The Glyn Jones mix of it.
I think it's... I mean, because you lose... The further you get away from its point of creation, then the less ownership you have over it, I suppose, which is a strange thing we're seeing as Beatles are sort of dying off in our lifetime, is that they don't really belong to them anymore. They've got a life of their own because that music is so rich and important within the culture that... Yeah, who knows where it will sort of end up in people's minds. Yeah.
And that's sort of a problem that I had when you know, I'd sort of exhausted all the studio albums and then sort of made the natural progression into diving into the anthology. I was reluctant to do that because I was a bit like, I've heard the perfect version. I've heard the version that the Beatles wanted me to hear. So... to sort of hear something that's almost that, but not quite that, and imperfect. I almost don't want to see the working out. I don't want to see the scaffolding. I want it to be in my life as a perfect thing.
Yeah.
And I was like that for a while. And the more I sort of listened to it, I sort of had to come to terms with the fact that, oh, no, the artistry comes from the work. It's not perfect in spite of the work. It's perfect because of the work.
Mm.
And I think hearing the layers go on and hearing the journeys that those songs take, that's got a real value to it that I didn't really buy into when I first heard about the anthology. And now, it's funny you're talking about that, there's a new... Because this is the 50th anniversary of everything. Every year there's a 50th anniversary edition of stuff coming out.
Mm.
Sometimes it feels a bit like we're being... slightly overwhelmed by a lot of that archive stuff, and you know, you buy the new anniversary edition of so and so album, and there's 50 tracks on it that you have to sort of work your way through, you do think, oh, well, this is a great luxury to have, but I'm probably only going to listen to all of these once, yeah. I think, and yeah. then go back to the perfect album. But as much as I tell myself, I'm not going to buy this 150 quid deluxe edition of this, I always end up doing it because the sort of gap on my shelf where it should be really starts to bother me. So I'm a real sort of completist like that. But I remember from the anthology to Love, say, in that sort of decade, 96 to sort of 2006, it didn't feel like they were as part of the conversation in that decade as they seem to be perpetually spoken about now.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It feels like when I was a sort of teen and getting into music, I was aware of them, obviously, but they didn't seem to be as sort of omnipresent as they are now. So,
that's right, isn't it? Because like McCartney played Glastonbury, was it 2004? And that didn't seem as kind of epoch defining as it would be now. Like McCartney was meant to play Glastonbury last year, wasn't he? And so, it was that kind of slight. I think it's a slightly pre-internet thing, maybe. Like now, I think there has been a resurgence in Beatles stuff in the last few years, but I think it has chimed with the kind of general. And the Beatles have actually done social media really well as well. Yeah, and they've kind of handled the legacy very well in terms of, as well, and kind of the lead up to Get Back and everything.
Yeah, they've kept relevant in a very sort of admirable way. And I think that a lot of that comes from the fact that there's still a youthfulness about those recordings, and there's still a youthful energy about them in a way that, even though the Stones were always supposed to be the dangerous, wild and crazy, rock, dirty sort of rock and roll band, I think that those early recordings of the Stones sound a bit, they've aged worse in terms of energy than I think the Beatles' early recordings
have. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And maybe it's something to do with, you know, John dying at 40. John was never seen old.
Mm.
John never really got old in the same way that that sort of Mick and Keith are just going to keep getting older, feels like.
Mm.
So maybe there's something to do with that. That energy seems to be much more preserved than it is for any other band. And so young people can still find a way of connecting with it. And I think young people always will connect with it. And they're aware of, you know, they don't just want to, they know that it's not just boomers who are going to buy these new editions. Yeah. They're targeting a young audience, and there's always going to be a younger audience there for them. And I think, that's been managed very, very well. You're right.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, like Gerald Martin was saying in an interview when he was remastering Sgt. Pepper, where he said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the tape, as in the tape is perfectly fine. Each track sound, the fidelity of it is great. Whereas I don't think you could say the same thing about, say, Village Green by the Kinks, which I think sounds...
That can only sound so good.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have the luxury of recording, you know, in Abbey Road or whatever. And I think, you know, the Kinks, much, you know, I love that album beyond language itself, but like that does sound very much of its time in a way that Sgt. Pepper is so pristine sounding for 67 and it's completely timeless because of the way it was recorded, you know. I think that's another reason it still sounds so fresh today, I think.
I think so, yeah. I think that's obviously a huge part of it. But I don't think that you can take away from the fact that when you hear those harmonies on She Loves You, for example, that still has a almost sort of adolescent playground sort energy to it. Cacophony of it sounds like 200 kids screaming at the top of their voices.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's held a magic to it. Where you hear songs from the 60s and they sound like old blokes, you know, great songs.
Yeah.
Like bands like, you know, the Small Faces. They're a young band, but they do sound quite old and mature.
Yeah.
And those recordings, they've sort of got a bit brown and flaky and a bit dusty.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Beatles never have. And that alchemy is quite fascinating to me, I think.
Very much so.
I think there's so much of that is to do with Hamburg and to do with them just playing on, like, uppers every night to, hundreds and hundreds of songs. And then I think... being in a studio, like I know exactly what you mean with those sort of early Stones records, and it's never more apparent than when they're sort of playing songs that Lennon McCartney have written that it just sounds very stifled. But then it kind of would be in a studio in the early 60s when you're sort of in your early 20s and you've got old men peering at you through windows and stuff. Like, how are you going to like rock out and get that energy into a record? Whereas the Beatles and the Decca tapes are kind of guilty of that a little bit.
Yeah.
But as soon as, well, kind of as soon as Ringo turned up, yeah, absolutely right. Those songs bounce off the acetate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And they sound like they were meant to go down in history.
Mm.
But they weren't at the time. No. They were recording because they wanted to get an album out quickly.
Yeah.
They wanted to get Please Please Me out, so they recorded most of it in one day and they released it quickly because there was a huge market for it. They didn't know it was going to be listened to by 18-year-old people in 50 years' time, but it sounds like they did mean that.
Mm.
You know what I mean? There's something that feels like... once again, it's probably us looking back on it, but they feel like they're carving their faces into Mount Rushmore on that first record.
Yeah.
But they weren't at the time. But because we know the way the story unfolded, those early albums, they have a weight to them that sort of we probably project onto it that wasn't there at the time of the recording, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, we culturally associate that with the high point of how it should sound. So it's kind of, it is that kind of combination of we are looking backwards and deciding that was the best thing.
Absolutely.
And you know, but I don't know. It's a really tricky one.
I think I can just about see in the background. Is that a telly? Had telly headstock I see in the background?
Of me? Whereabouts? Have
you got a Telecaster behind you?
Oh, a telly? Yes, I thought you meant a telly.
Yeah. Yes,
so are you a guitar player? Well, obviously you're a guitar player, but...
Not really, no. I mean, I try. Well, do you know what? I don't even really try. I'm not a student of it, and I can't really learn songs that well. I just like to move chords around, just for my own sort of experimentation. If I was gonna, you know, I play the drums more than anything else. But I'm in a I'm in a flat here. I'm on the 16th floor of an apartment. I've got slightly old people sort of in every direction. So I've had to sort of park that a bit. I've still got an electric kit at my mum's. Which I go and play every now and again, but no, the guitar was my dad played guitar when I was growing up in quite a limited way, but he got a lot of pleasure out of it. There was never a performative element to it.
Mm.
He didn't learn songs either. He just learnt chords and sort of worked out his own little tunes, and that's what I do as well. I find it quite contemplative and quite meditative in a way. And if there ever was a chance to do any sort of performative angle to it, I think I'd shy away from that. I just don't want it to be public. I want it to be something that's quite personal and something that I do to relax rather than having the stress of playing for people. But drums is slightly different. I'd be much more comfortable performing drums, probably because I'm a better at the drums than I ever would be at the guitar. But I just find drumming to be more. I'm better at the sort of primal, instinctive side of music than I am any kind of theory. For some reason, I just don't have the kind of brain that retains that information. My sort of muscle memory for learning songs isn't quite there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But neither do I necessarily want it to be. That's the thing. I just do what I do on it, you know.
Yeah. But so, was music a big part of you, like while you were getting into acting as well, or what was your first? Were they married passions, or did you always keep them quite separate?
I've always kept them quite separate because I can't sing a note, and I've never ever been able to sing, and so it was quite clear that that side of acting and that side of performance was never going to be a part of my arsenal, if you like. I was never going to be a triple threat. I find people who were able to sing properly like a superpower almost.
Yeah.
I find sort of playing a musical instrument hard enough, but the idea that you can pick the right note out of the air and somehow make your throat behave in a way which means you can produce that note, it almost feels impossible. Yeah. Well, singing is one of those things. I think people who can do it find it easy, and people who can't do it find it impossible, and we'll never be able to do it. So luckily, because of that, I can still keep music as recreational and something that I get entertainment from, rather, because you know, watching telly now and watching films, there's no doubt that you do see it differently once you start to do it. You can't quite. I'm sure it's the same with comedy. I'm sure it's the same with, you know, music. If you can do it properly, you can never experience music in that detached way ever again. And I find that with acting,
right,
that I watch a film and I'm a bit like, oh, I can see a bit of additional dub in there, or I can see that they cut something out there. They cut from there to there because they wanted to leave this out.
Or a Starbucks cup or something.
even something as ridiculous as that.
Yeah, yeah.
Something as unlikely as that. You just find that
it feels like you've like really compartmentalized, because I mean, you talked about not your muscle memory not working with music, but surely there's that something's going on when you're learning lines and things. Is that not a similar skill set when you're learning lines for acting and performing and using your voice, which is what acting is? You know, it's like, do you not?
I suppose it is, but I also think that if you are versed in musical theory and the logic of music, you can probably pick that up quite easily because you sort of know what the rules are, and you know that there's a template for a lot of music that you can sort of slip into, and you can make sense of it almost like a language.
Yeah.
And I don't have that ability to lock into music as a language like that, or as a set of rules. Whereas when I learn lines, I am projecting meaning onto it and logic onto it. For example, if I was to try and learn music, it would be like learning lines in a foreign language that I don't speak.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison. Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know if it's different parts of the brain or what, but learning something that you can make sense of and learning something that you can't make sense of, even though some of the same processes are happening, it just feels like it's a step beyond my capability.
Yeah, just anecdotally, in my experience, people who are really good actors are much better at learning lines because for exactly what you say, like the lines mean more to them. They process them in a different way, and that's why they're good at interpreting them, because they see more of a story for them, or like how they're going to represent that line. Like teaching trying to teach people grade 5 theory who are not very good at music is an absolute nightmare because it doesn't make any sense to them in their head. So
yeah,
it's a good comparison.
But I can imagine that there are instinctive musicians in the way that there are instinctive actors, and there are some musicians who are bogged down in their theory in the same way that some actors are bogged down in their theory. Like, I remember having a conversation with an actor I was working with. I went to drama school, and this other actor hadn't gone to drama school. They'd learnt on the job, as it were. And they wanted me to speed my delivery up so they could bounce off me and come in a little bit quicker after my line was said.
Right.
And then I said, no, I can't speed it up because there's a full stop in the middle of that line, which means I have to pause there. If I just say it all as one thing, I'm ignoring the punctuation. And they said, God, you're such a fucking actor. They really said it with a lot of sort of contempt in a way. But I think that that's what it is. Some people have to. Some people see a script as being like a musical score, where all the clues are there as to how you're supposed to deliver this.
Yeah.
They put a full stop in there for a reason. The same way they put a G in there instead of a D.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Mm. But some people sort of disregard that. And
but I think it's really interesting listening to the way you're talking about music and instinctive musician, because it's so Lennon, isn't it? I mean, I think what...
Oh, I was just about to say, yeah. So Paul.
Oh, really? Because I think Lennon's, the way he writes songs is very instinctive, and he doesn't care for theory, and he doesn't know theory, and, you know, it's just piecing the chords together that sound good, and it taps into something of the subconscious. So I think that's all of Lennon's best songs, melodically, because he's feeling his way, it seems to tap into something very primal, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, but I think that is true. But I also think that what's so clear about the way Paul writes songs is whether it's, you know, consciously or subconsciously, you can tell that he's been exposed to a lot of different styles of music and a lot of different musical modes.
Yeah.
Like a lot of his modes are sort of, you know, 500-year-old choral mode that he's sort of plucking out of the air.
Yeah.
And that's why I think Paul McCartney is the greatest songwriting talent in popular music of all time, because he can write you a great song in any style.
Mm.
I think Lennon is a different kind of genius, but Paul is so versatile and he has music running through him like, you know, like Blackpool Rock. He can just do it. He just processes music in a way that's also instinctive. I don't think he's too theoretical either, but I think he absorbs influence.
Yeah.
And he's able to paint that and colour his own work with that in a way. With Lennon, I think it's always coming from within in a way.
Mm.
And Paul's able to take things and... For example, Lennon writes about himself usually, or he writes in quite abstract ways about things that don't really make sense.
Mm.
Whereas Paul does those things as well, but Paul also writes about other people in a biographical sense.
Yeah.
Like he'll write about Desmond and he'll write about Eleanor Rigby and you know, he'll write biographical stories about other people.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that Lennon never did, because his instinct was to either say how he was feeling in metaphorical ways or in raw personal ways.
And I think that's what makes like Mr. Kite so interesting as a Lennon song, isn't it? Because there isn't another Lennon song like that, I think, where he's, you know, using other names. And obviously he's got it from this poster, but he's creating a world. And there's something kind of very, I mean... It's funny. So only since really doing this podcast that I've really got on board with being for the benefit of Mr. Kite. But like, it's a real. There's a sort of sadness to it that Lennon sort of didn't ever really write another song in that mode again. I think, or maybe he did. I'm sure someone could point.
Bungalow Bill's sort of.
Bungalow Bill. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that's characters, isn't it? And true. Yeah, and Crybaby Cry as well.
But I guess you can see that the songs that Lennon was really dismissive of were sort of Maxwell Silverhammer and because I'd say he had absolutely zero interest in things that didn't ring true or that were slight like ephemeral or going back to the sort of music, the theory of it, it's like that's what makes him brilliant. Like you would not want John Lennon to have any like regard for form in any musical way, because then he wouldn't it's not that he really, I mean, we talk about him breaking the rules, but he's just completely nihilistic about the rules. Yeah. He just doesn't give a shit about them.
Yeah.
And then you can create something genuinely like Strawberry Fields, like that doesn't adhere to anything. It's just plucked out of the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But I think in defense of Paul along those lines, I think what Paul is capable of doing, and he's even said in an interview that I heard a while ago that he does this, is that he's so aware of what's expected from a melody.
Mm.
He's so aware that an audience will latch onto a melody, and because they've heard so many melodies before in their lives, they'll be able to guess where it's going to go. And because he knows that's what they're thinking, he knows he can twist it.
Mm. I'm going to go over here.
Yeah, exactly. He knows that he knows that he can make it interesting, and he'll find a note or a chord that they weren't expecting because it sort of subverts their expectation of melody. And I think it's a different process, but he can only do that if he's aware of what the rules are.
Yeah, that's such a brilliant way of putting it, I think. Yeah. Fool on the Hill springs to mind, doesn't it? You just wouldn't expect it to go there. To
exactly.
That minor chord or whatever.
And you know, fixing a hole.
Yeah.
Fixing a hole is another one, which they're a sort of... Not that I'm a huge fan of it, and we can talk about that a little bit later on again, but in terms of there are twists and turns that melody takes where you go, oh, hang on a minute. And and because of that, I think it's a deeply unsettling listen.
Yeah,
that's fixing a hole, because you never quite know where you stand with it. Yeah. It's like shifting sand under your feet.
Yeah.
And he's very good at finding adding little bits of colour that make you sit upright. And that's why I think when he's at his best, it's not as easy listening as some people give him discredit for.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. Mm. That's such a great point about fixing a hole. It is unsettling. I think it's like someone's come round to fix a leak, but he's clearly tripping tripping balls. Yeah. You know, it's just
a very everyday thing. Straight, straight crotchet harpsichord intro that has no resemblance to the rest of the song.
Yeah.
And so when that completely just disappears and then it just turns into like a swing tune.
Yeah.
A swung tune that's completely like a different tempo.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, right, okay.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I know that this may feel a bit early, but I think that this is a decent jumping off point for my controversial opinion.
Okay,
actually.
Cool.
Let's rip up the rule book.
and it is that the Beatles dabbling or plunging headfirst into hallucinogenics and acid and, the, as George called it, the dreaded lysergic. LSD.
It looked like a bit of rope.
I think it had a profound effect on their music, and I think the predominant effect it had on it was that it made it a bit boring.
Whoa. That's interesting.
That's interesting.
I think, and by the way, that's not to say that I don't think it's incredible, colossal art, because I think it is.
Yeah.
In the same way that I actually think a lot of other great art is a bit boring to experience, in terms of a lot of Shakespeare's boring, War and Peace is a great book, but it's a bit of a boring book, and a lot of those classical symphonies are a bit boring.
Yeah,
I just think that compared to, as we were talking about, the energy and the urgency of those early recordings, sort of right up until that psychedelic period, I think that's got an immediacy to it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that psychedelic stuff, I find it a bit dull. And at the last count, I've got 7 copies of Sgt. Pepper in various in various formats.
Nice.
Most of it I don't listen to that often anymore.
That's interesting. This is
going to be something that. I think you're going to have a bit of pushback on. And I know for a fact that there are people who've been on this very podcast who I admire greatly and I've got a lot of respect for who basically put across the opposite case of what I'm going to say here. And that is,
that's the joy of it.
Yeah.
There are only two songs on Sgt. Pepper that I categorically love. And I mean love properly. The rest
Should we
of
have
them,
a guess?
Yeah, go on.
She's Leaving
Day
Home.
Day in the Life.
She's Leaving Home.
She's Leaving Home.
No. Day in the Life, yeah,
Day
of course.
The Life.
Just because A Day in the Life is...
Okay. Oh, is it Mr. Kite?
No, it's not. Think of the worst thing I could possibly say.
When I'm 64?
Yeah.
Oh, fair play.
It is when I'm 64. Yeah. And
I'm an apologist for when I'm 64 too.
I used to really... I've actually, you know, like on... If you ever have Time Hop, one of those apps or something.
Yeah.
And it was a tweet I did about 5 years. A hot take, obviously, after I'd had several cans, where I said there's actually only three good Beatles albums.
Wow.
Revolver, White Album, and Abbey Road. Because I was my opinion was Sgt. Pepper only had a couple of good songs on, which I've changed my mind.
Awful thing to say.
Completely awful, yeah. I take it back. But that's basically what I was saying was, in terms of the canonization of Sgt. Pepper, is sort of similar to what John is saying, is that the time I thought there's only a couple of good songs on it.
I think that this is the key difference. I think they're all good songs, but they're not necessarily songs that I want to listen to a lot. The thing about When I'm 64, well, a lot of people have said have written it off as a children's song. The fact is, it's a children's song because it was written by one. He was 14 years old when he wrote it, and the idea that not just a band, but the band that's at the forefront of the youth movement at the time.
Yeah.
The fact that they're writing these songs about what it's like to be an old couple.
Yeah.
I think that's a very, actually, quite rebellious and dangerous and kind of fuck you thing to do.
Yeah.
And if everybody else was writing about getting out of your mind and the previous generation were bollocks to them because we're young and this is our moment. The fact that, you know, it's a very mature and sensitive vignette of an old couple. And they're not even a rich old couple because they might not be able to afford to go to the Isle of Wight if it's too dear. They're a poor old couple and he's writing about them on one of the biggest selling albums of all time. I think that shows unbelievable sensitivity and maturity, and I think it's an absolutely beautiful record. Yeah. Okay, there's some rhyming couplets, you know, Save and Dave. It's quite a naive rhyming couplet, but I sort of like that about it. I like the fact that it was written by a 14-year-old, and I want it to sound like that.
Yeah,
it's a bit like how old was Mozart when he wrote Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star? It's not a sort of perfect tune, but it's amazing because it was written by a little kid.
It's interesting they did. I might be wrong with this, but they did Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane first, and this was the start of the Pepper project. And it was like, well, that's the double A side, and then the first song after for Pepper proper was When I'm 64, wasn't it? I think that was the first song.
Yeah.
So that is kind of interesting to think that was the jumping off point. Because
it was probably when there was more of a sort of planned more as a sort of concept album, and that would have been a bit of light relief
in the
first side. But I think it's really sweet. I have no problem with it.
I think it's really really sweet, but I think just because of my artistic sensibilities, I get more from that than I get from Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Right.
I get more than that than I get from abstract, you know, quite sort of revealing but kind of impersonal imagery. Mm. I'd rather have a little vignette about what it's like to be the mundane life of an old couple in a sort of Alan Bennett sort of...
She's Leaving Home then?
She's Leaving Home is the same in terms of, you know, the great thing about that, it's been said before, but the great thing about that is it takes the parent's perspective into account.
Mm.
And...
Because that's that similar sort of thing.
Yeah, you feel sorry.
It's not exactly my generation, is it?
Yeah. No, exactly. You feel sorry for the parents in that. But I just think that she's leaving home just musically. It's very delicate and very, very well crafted. But I just don't... I'm just not sort of excited by that in a sort of musical, sensory way. The instrument, maybe you can tell me, I'm not quite sure what it is. It sounds like a string instrument that goes into the part of When I'm 64, which is...
Clarinet, I think, isn't it?
Is it clarinet, which goes into...
Yeah, it's a concert band, really, so it's like a clarinet and a tuba.
The sort of note that goes into the Every Summer We Can Rent a Cottage in the Isle of Wight. Yeah, but that note feels like it comes out of nowhere as well. Like it suddenly goes wistful.
Yeah.
It suddenly goes wistful because of that.
Yeah.
When I get older, it doesn't start wistful.
No.
But yeah, but also that idea, once again, the poetry's there for a reason, whether it's conscious or not, the idea that, you know, you'll be older too.
Yeah.
There's something about that that's a bit like old, you know, you are tomorrow's old person.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And to think as well, you know, on the previous album he'd done Eleanor Rigby, that, you know, that was very shocking in a new direction and sort of one of Paul's first kind of writing songs from a different perspective. It is strange that, you know, She's Leaving Home, Eleanor Rigby, When I'm 64, they do deal with the older generation.
because Paul's I think even now a very compassionate bloke. It feels like he, you know, you can just tell in interviews the way he talks about his dad and talks about his sort of growing up. You sort of get a sense that he's tried his hardest to maintain a position in the sort of landscape that he grew up. I don't think you'd have ever got him leaving for New York and never coming back.
Yeah.
I just don't think he'd have ever done that. I mean, even that cordon thing, the carpool karaoke thing, you can see that him going back home means something to him quite deeply. I think he's nostalgic by nature.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And I think that I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Part of the sort of rule book should be, oh, you get out there and you leave it behind and you sort of grow out of that and you educate yourself out of it. And anyone who's not in your new circle that you deserve to belong to, you leave them behind. I don't think Paul's ever been as cynical and has ever been as sort of trenchant in his view of that. I think he misses his Liverpool days. And part of him probably still thinks, wonder what it was like if this never happened and I was just an old bloke in Liverpool. Would I be considerably unhappier? Probably not. I'd just be sort of getting on with it.
Yeah.
He's a person to whom everyday mundane life, he can still see the beauty and the poetry in it. And I think that that's something that all the best writers do, I think. And that's why Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds will never mean as much to me as When I'm 64, even if it is a more towering technical achievement. I just will never have that relationship with it the same.
Dorian Lynskey, the journalist, wrote a thing this week which is about sort of in defence of hatchet jobs, as in, you know, people shouldn't be afraid to give terrible reviews of things because it's become a bit more unfashionable recently. And I said, I thought it was a really good article, and I said one of the reasons I like Revolution in the Head is that it's so subjective and he really, really doesn't like some songs. And Dorian Lynskey replied saying, you know, that's right, but the thing I don't like about Ian McDonald is he's so critical of the drug taking, and he's sort of like saying, you know, he says a similar thing to you, I think, that it resulted in more self-indulgent music. Which Dorian,
and it's undeniably self-indulgent.
It is self-indulgent, I love all that stuff. I mean, like Blue Jay Way is one of my favourite.
Yeah, but if you lose, I understand that it often goes down the line of a lot of people are either kind of pre-67 or post And that's where, and it's that distinction, isn't it? It's like, do you like the energy and the explosiveness of the band that ripped up the rule book, or the band that took it to the next level?
I guess so. The thing that I'll keep saying until I'm blue in the face is that I still think it's all great.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just my connection with it is lacking. But then again, you know, you say sort of pre and post. I think whether the drugs just wore off or they moved on to different drugs, but they tired of it quite quickly.
Mm.
They tired of their psychedelic phase, and they went. They stripped it all back for the White Album, and then their last two albums, are more or less, apart from things like Across the Universe, they're more sort of straight ahead rock and roll records again.
Mm.
And I think that was them. Even they checked themselves and said, "Might be going a bit far here, actually." And we're rock and rollers at heart.
Yeah.
And that was when we sort of enjoyed it the most, probably. So let's get back to doing that. Do you know what I think part of it is? I think it's that I've always loved... One of my favourite things about the Beatles is them as musicians playing instruments. And I want to hear them playing their instruments.
Mm.
And I think with all the layers and the tape loops and the sound effects and everything that was layered on top of it, the more they add... the less I connect with it, because I want to hear the four of them playing their instruments.
That's really interesting.
And I think you're sort of removed from that in stuff like I Am the Walrus, which is an unbelievable record. Once again, unbelievable record.
Yeah.
But all that stuff, I just want to hear the four of them in a room playing their instruments.
That's really mainly. That's so interesting. Because I was just going to say, I Am the Walrus is a song that it is exactly what you're saying, and it is layered, and it's got very far away from four people playing in a room, and there's King Lear coming in at the end, and all of the noises and the, you know, Oompa Loompas and stuff. And but I think, and also Lennon's lyric being so inscrutable, and deliberately so, because it was kind of almost like a kind of see if you can read any meaning into this. But like I think the more you listen to I Am the Walrus, and it's probably me getting old, but I think there is a meaning to it. I think I Am the Walrus does mean something, and I think it is a kind of it's a sort of Pink Floyd The Wall a few years earlier, where it's a kind of, it's like having a go at expert texperts, you know, and it's like, say, I'm creating a new language, I'm not obeying your rules, you know, and I think that is what the song is about. And I think it's interesting because although it doesn't have the literal quality of a song like I Am 64, I think there's a real emotional and a real meaning to it, weirdly. But maybe that's just because I don't know.
But there's something about John that's such a sort of, there's such a slippery fish.
Yeah.
The you know, expert texperts, don't you think the Joker laughs at you?
Yeah.
That could even be a comment on, in the same way that Glass Onion was a sort of comment on all the people who think they know what this is about.
Yeah.
Just chill out a bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's true.
The reason I got into the Beatles into my big Beatles phase, which started about 2008, was sort of through the back door. It was a slightly obsessive Paul is Dead trip.
Oh right,
I went on. I bought an issue of Q years. This was just before then, and it came with a little booklet which was like rock and roll factoids or something.
Yeah. Mm.
And I was just reading it one night, and it said like the top 10 rock and roll conspiracy theories. And so I read it, and it just said, some people to this day believe that Paul McCartney died in 66 and was replaced, and there are certain clues on album covers and in the albums, like the Barefoot thing on Abbey Road. Mm. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, like this is... First of all, how have I never heard of this? And also, how can I find out more about it? We didn't have the internet at home then.
Mm.
We didn't get it till 2008, so as soon as we got it, I delved deep into it.
Yeah.
Sort of started to buy the album secondhand, and sort of became unhealthily obsessed with it, which meant that I mean, eventually it wore off,
yeah.
And I just started to listen to them for what they are. But that meant for the first few months of my sort of obsessive Beatles fandom, the records had a sort of darkness hanging, like a sort of sinister, a sinister sort of sheen on them. Because if you're listening to something because you think something's in it that's going to scare you. They have like a cloak over them, which I couldn't really see them as. I saw them as a sort of there's something about them where, especially like the White Album, which is the sort of peak of that. The White Album, some elements of it scare me to death to this day.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Because I can't sort of disassociate it with that idea of staying up till 4 in the morning to deliberately freak yourself out with all these backwards messages and stuff.
Yeah.
That was my sort of second way in. And then I got to the stage where I'd go online looking at all the clues, and then I'd find clues myself that have not been written about anywhere else.
Oh, wow.
That's me just being a bit hypersensitive. For example, don't to show you
something, yes, please.
I don't think has been written about anywhere else. This, as you'll be well aware... By the way, you're not going to agree with this. Let me just tell you before we start. You're going to think this is bollocks, and it probably is.
John is holding up a Magical Mystery Tour.
Magical Mystery Tour
vinyl LP.
This is the back cover.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So it's, yeah.
This is all people standing on this staircase from the Magical Mystery Tour film. There's the Beatles.
Yeah.
They're all in this formation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I became convinced for a while that this here...
Yeah.
Is a screaming face.
Oh my. Oh yeah, I can see it.
Two eyes, a nose, and a big, wide open mouth screaming.
That is, right? Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
We'll post a picture of that on our Instagram so you can follow along.
I've never seen anybody else write about this.
No.
But now I can't see it.
Yeah.
I can't look at it without
seeing
it.
You can't unsee it.
The Magical Mystery Tour, Paul's wearing a black carnation. Isn't that one of the clues? Yeah.
Yeah, and apparently those flowers are incredibly rare. The idea that they wouldn't have a red one and they'd had a black one is almost impossible. But the one that people never... And I'll get onto sort of my reasons behind it. The one that people poo-poo these clues a lot, and they just say there's no evidence of, you know, any burial being in bare feet or any culture that has a hand over the head that means death. There's not, okay, right. But on Sergeant Pepper, the cover.
Yeah.
Do you know this thing about if you put a mirror across where it says Sergeant Pepper on the bass drum? Have you heard this one?
Yeah, I've heard this. Yeah.
It says in the mirror. Like you see it split, and it says one, like a number one, the word one, and then another number one, an X, and then he, arrow up to Paul, die.
Right. Yeah.
That's what it says.
Yeah.
I've done it myself, and you just think, that's too perfect for it to not be deliberate. And I think if you put a mirror across that bass drum, and it said... jam sandwiches.
Or cranberry sauce.
Yeah. You'd be like, fucking hell, it says jam sandwiches. That's weird.
Yeah.
But the fact that it says something that's in the complete logic of this myth, you think that's... Not only is it weird enough that by accident it'd say something, but the fact that it says something and that chimes with what this conspiracy theory is, that seems a bit too weird. And
I think as you said with Glass Onion, the Beatles definitely did play up to stuff. I mean, I saw a thing on Twitter today, which was quite kind of mind-blowing, which is that, you know, the number 9 to them was really significant.
Yeah.
And if you include the "Can you take me back where I came from" as part of Revolution 9... then the whole piece is exactly 9 minutes long.
Well, wow.
Yeah.
So what I mean? That can't be...
So that's deliberate, obviously, you know.
Of course.
Yeah.
Is it?
It must be.
It has to be.
It could be a coincidence.
I don't believe that Paul is dead. I've never believed that.
No, but I mean, for John to be putting... to do a whole song of clues with Glass Onion, they're obviously playing up to it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yes, but Robin, it says he died on the bass drum. Why do people talk about other clues?
Why is grammar so bad with these clues? Yeah. Why is it he died?
I beg your pardon. Right. But it's not because I think he's dead. I just literally do think that it's more of a testament to what I feel the Beatles are capable of.
Right.
I believe that they could insert this myth into their work to be discovered for a slightly sick joke. Mm. And I believe that they're capable. They're even capable, I'd say, of writing songs that are meaningful forward and beautiful forward and also meaningful backwards. Mm. I genuinely do believe with some of the other backward stuff that they did before then. Mm. And then when Love came out,
yeah,
they said, with the cover of Love, they said there's a clue on the cover of Love for a secret code.
Oh, right.
And you put a mirror across Love, in the word Love, in the way that you put it across the Sgt. Pepper's bass drum, and it says code in the mirror.
Right. Yeah.
Now, that's them being aware of that mirror placement gag.
Yeah.
Mm.
So there's no way that it can't... Anyway, yeah. but I'm not saying that he's dead. I'm saying that they are talented enough that they can have this entire sub-narrative running through all their work. I wouldn't be surprised if it's true.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely so much mischief in there. I mean...
Well, do you know the famous one about putting the dog whistle at the end of Day in the Life as well, wasn't it? I mean, they were, you know, the frequency only audible to dogs and things. There's definitely fucking about, no doubt about it.
He also used to quite like, wasn't there a thing that when he stayed in hotel rooms, he used to like draw big, like weird murals behind the pictures.
What do you think they're saying at the end of, you know, the run out groove?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think they're saying there? Because it's never quite been established what they're saying.
No.
For me, it always sounded like wouldn't want it any other way. But it isn't that.
Is it not that?
But you said it was something to do with Superman.
Well, it sounds a bit like fuck you, Superman. Or something like that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Does it? I think, because it sounds to me like either never could be any other way or never could be any other one. Mm. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
But imagine. But are they trying to say that it's nothing? Are they trying to say that it's completely? Is the party line that it's meaningless, or have they just not told us what the meaning is? I'm not quite sure what the official party line is.
It's just so weird, isn't it?
If I was a betting man, it would probably be one of those things where something got pressed wrong,
right?
And then they were like, oh, that's cool.
It takes a lot of work to do a locked groove at an end. It's very, very deliberate to do
if they were told it was possible, they would like must have not known it was possible to do, and then they were like, let's... You know, that's their spirit of enterprise.
I mean, I say that every record's got a locked groove, hasn't it? Shut up, Robin.
Yeah, but to put something looping on at the end.
But I think, I remember in the first episode, I saw this mad thing of like, get really into the Beatles and think maybe they didn't exist, like it was government propaganda for the post-war era. But then I found like that is actually a genuine conspiracy theory. Some people do actually think that the Beatles didn't exist. Yeah. That some, you know, it was just, because like the FBI funded, you know, like avant-garde art in the 60s to kind of show how tolerant and forward-thinking the West was and stuff like that. You know, there was all that kind of stuff going on.
Well, it sort of sounds like a bit... I project some sort of ulterior motive onto these things. Like, it's the same as the Shakespeare myth that he didn't write any of these plays and it was the Earl of wherever.
Yeah.
There's always something about that which makes me think, oh, that is academics saying that a glovemaker's son from the Midlands isn't clever enough to write all those plays. Mm. It had to be an aristocrat. Yeah, yeah. It had to be somebody learned. And I think it's almost as if people can't bear the fact that it was four lads from working class lads, obviously working to lower middle class lads from Liverpool, untrained in music, that achieved all this. Mm. There's something about that that doesn't compute.
Yeah,
and it seems like a magic trick. It's like there's no, it's not possible that they were that good.
Yeah,
based on nothing. Mm. They just arrived and were incredible.
But that's it kind of goes back to what we were saying about, like, they now defined what we think of as good as well. You know, so yeah. That's the kind of... God, this has got really, really heavy stuff, hasn't it?
But I think whenever people... When people are confronted with genuine sort of once-in-a-century genius, yeah. then there's always going to be people who... like, you know, loads of people who said that Leopold Mozart wrote all Mozart stuff when he was a certain age. Might be a modicum of truth yeah. to some of that. But, yeah, it doesn't make sense to people in the same way that... You know, talk about singing as a superpower. What
yeah.
is fucking yeah. what they did is absolutely
exactly.
unbelievable. Yeah. So it makes more sense to write it.
It's
off.
Almost like if that was an FBI conspiracy yeah. and they had teams of writers writing all of this music for the government, they went way too far with yeah. it. Yeah. Like they made it too good.
Yeah, it was too good.
If it was a conspiracy and all constructed, it wouldn't have got that good.
Yeah.
Because nobody'd buy it. You know what I mean? Nobody'd buy that it was real.
Yeah.
Because it's that astonishing. So it has to be true.
Yeah.
Because nobody'd believe it if it was false.
Also, it was obviously so successful. Why didn't they do it again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Why just get sort of 7-8 years out of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, they probably tried it again in the 80s with just a band Bross. That just didn't take off.
Kershaw.
Try it again with Bross.
Yeah. Oh, God. You know, you mentioned before when you were doing Game of Thrones, you know, this Beatles quiz. Yeah. But when you were doing the project for, you know, a decade, did you bond with anyone specifically about music or about the Beatles? Were there kind of friendships you made kind of with the Beatles and things like that on, you know, while you were working on that project for so long?
It's so interesting to talk about that, actually, because the one person who I have bonded closest with specifically about the Beatles is Isaac Hampstead Wright, who's Bran.
Oh,
Stark.
Right, wow. Mm.
He loves them.
Right.
And I've known him since he was in single digits, yeah. since he was sort of eight, nine years old, and now he's 19, 20. Mm. And it's so interesting to see that journey from not knowing about the Beatles to gradually becoming the super fan that he is of the Beatles
wow.
now.
Mm. Cool.
It's almost seeing Beatles fandom take hold in sort of real time.
Yeah.
That yeah. I think that...
If only Rob Stark had listened to you about the Beatles.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just a lovely thing that they are... When you're born, it's almost as if for people who are born who are meant to be Beatles fans... It's like they're taking a path, and the Beatles are taking another path, and they'll meet eventually.
Yeah,
yeah.
You'll find that you'll be at a crossroads in your life when you and the Beatles will meet, and you'll know it's the right time, yeah. and you'll know something special is happening.
Do you remember, like, there was a meme going round mid-series, where it was like how does Bran look like all of the Beatles at the same time? Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
so weird.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, he's yeah. There's worse people to look like than all of the Beatles.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's sort of obsessed with them in the same way that I am, and that's really nice that it's not your love of the Beatles doesn't depend on anything.
Mm.
It doesn't depend on what generation. What sort of financial background you come from, where geographically you come from. They're just for everybody. And if you're meant to discover them, you will discover them. And and that's the thing about casual Beatles fans that I find quite frustrating. The people who say... Actually, people who say that they don't like the Beatles at all, I can sort of cope with them because I think... Well, just shut up. That's just bollocks because there's no way that you dislike Please Please Me and I Am the Walrus for the same reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
There has to be, if you do dislike them, which I don't even believe, they have to be for different reasons. And they can't.
You're being difficult. You're
just being difficult. But almost as if casual Beatles fans who say, oh, I like the one the number one's greatest hits, but I don't look any deeper than that. I always think that they're worse. I tolerate them less,
right,
for their sort of lack of curiosity in a way.
Right, yeah.
That once you start looking and deep diving into the Beatles, it's a journey that you'll never forget for the rest of your life, because you realise what they are, because they're essentially, even though they produce some of the greatest pop singles of all time, it's only when you really get into the albums that you know the journey that they went on. Mm. And each album speaks for itself as a sort of monument and a place in time. I don't think you can get a sense of that through the singles in the same way.
No.
I don't think.
Mm.
Wow. So what did Bran get into? I mean, so is Bran now real super fan, or has he kind of got a favourite era, or what's the... Sorry, I'm just calling him Bran, which is his
name. Yeah, old Bran.
Yeah.
He
old Bran.
Old Bran all the time. he seems to be across it all. We've played sort of guess the song from the first note and stuff like that. He's across all of that.
Wow.
So not quite as good as me. but he's properly invested in it. And that's a nice thing to see, that just sort of gives you faith that they're not. I mean, if they were going to disappear, they'd have disappeared by now.
Mm.
But it's nice to see that teenagers are going to continue that legacy on, and they're just not going to go away, are they?
No.
They're just not.
No. And that's why, this thing of tinkering with the legacy and releasing all these things. Like, if one comes out that I'm not that happy with, it doesn't mean anything to me, but it might mean that a whole new bunch of people find it when they release it as a syringe that you inject into your brain. It's fine by me.
Yeah.
You know, more the merrier. So,
No pressure, but if you had to say, if you could save one song from a shipwreck Beatles-wise.
I would say, for me personally, or for like the human race?
For you personally.
Oh, I mean, if I had to save one for posterity, I would go for Strawberry Fields.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Yesterday.
Yeah, that would be pretty close. But but Yesterday, like we were saying sort of at the beginning of this podcast, like Yesterday and Strawberry Fields are kind of the two extremes of the Lennon and McCartney sort of strong songwriting genius, really.
Yeah.
But if I had to take one for me forever, that if I could never hear one ever again apart from one, I'd probably take I Want You, She's So Heavy.
All right.
Oh, fantastic choice.
Because it's really long.
Yeah.
It is long.
It's got a bit of everything, hasn't it?
A lot of value for money, yeah.
Mm.
What about you, Rob?
I mean, this is a total... I've always had such a soft spot for Cry Baby Cry. And even though it was a bit of a throwaway song, I think I just love Lennon's lyric, the domesticity of it, the kind of almost twee picture he creates of this slightly odd aristocratic family, you know, with the seance. There's so much detail in it, and you can kind of get lost in that world he creates. And I just think it's a beautiful song, brilliant melody. Well, what about you, John?
Well, after all my talk of you have to dig deep and the singles are not enough and you really get a sense of them from their albums, my favourite Beatles song is now always and always probably will be She Loves You.
Wow. Cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that stuff we're talking about preserving it in amber, it will never fail to have an effect on anybody that hears it.
Mm.
And even back then, in their own small way, they weren't doing backwards messages yet. They weren't doing tape loops and all that kind of stuff. But they were still breaking the rules.
Yeah.
Mm.
In terms of starting with a chorus, finishing on a note or a chord that you'd never expect them to finish on.
Yeah.
That moment where you think it's over and then it blasts back in for sort of one final volley in sort of 2 minutes as a sort of setting their stall out and announcing themselves to the world. You just can't get any better than that. And I can only imagine, you try and imagine because it's like a nursery rhyme almost, and these songs have just been around for as long as we've been conscious of stuff. Hearing that for the first time must have been exhilarating, bordering on terrifying.
Yeah. I just amazed. Have you seen that footage of Anfield in the early 60s where they're singing She Loves You?
Yeah.
It's just amazing, incredible.
It definitely has that power. And if you ever stick it on towards the end of a wedding, it goes down like an absolute banger.
Really?
Oh, people go crazy for it. Yeah.
Oh, they were just so incredible. Yeah. They were always incredible, but I mean, you know, I said it on another thing when they asked Lemmy they asked Lemmy, who he said he saw them at the Cavern. And he said, and did you know, they said it in a loaded way, did you know that they were going to be the biggest band in the world when you saw them in that club? And he said, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. He said, yeah. Just, they were just magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their magic changed and, you know, they went on such a journey. But when they were young and the, you know, late teens into early 20s, they must have just been phenomenal.
Yeah.
It must have been like every because also they were the first ones to sort of be, they sort of set the template for what it was to be a fan of a band as well. So it's not even like people who, you know, One Direction fans and whatever flavor of the month is at the moment. At least they're part of a lineage of fandom that they can insert themselves in, and this is the band that I like at the time that I'm the right age to be liking bands. But the teenagers in the sort of early 60s, they just didn't even know what was happening.
No.
Yeah.
They just didn't know how to react to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't performative. They were screaming because they felt like it, because they couldn't hold it in.
Yeah.
When you see that footage, I find it very moving. Like all of that, the footage that's in... 8 days a week that was shot at Manchester Apollo, as a matter of fact. Just seeing what they meant to those fans, I find it really moving. And all of the live concert footage, that Washington concert that's on the anthology, where the version of Saw Her Standing There that's on that, when Ringo is just bashing the drums.
Yeah.
He's smashing the drums with everything he's got. It really lays to rest all of that, any myths that might be lingering that they were a sort of a rumpty-tumpty-tumpty kind of, you know, almost a sort of cabaret band.
Yeah.
They were basically a punk band before punk bands were even a thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I hold that early stuff so close to my heart, and I'd give anything to be there. But, you know, that's why that song, for me, will never lose its power, because I know what it means to me, but I try and imagine what it meant to those people as well. And you almost can't get your head around it.
Yeah.
So that was John Bradley's Personal Beatles, and a fascinating time it was had by all.
Yes, I loved that. It was great.
Yeah.
I do stand by what I was saying about I Am the Walrus. I think I Am the Walrus is an anti-authority song.
Despite
this nonsense, but I didn't quite articulate it very well, but
it's fascinating stuff. And it was probably one of the hardest extended ones to cut, because it also was also good. So if you want to hear an extended version of that and you're not a member of our Patreon, you can join it by going to patreon.com/personalbeatles, where you'll get ad-free extended versions of that and every other podcast in this series, as well as some bonus ones, so you can hear about our trip to Abbey Road with Ellis James and our second volume of our Personal Beatles, and an upcoming one as well, where we're going to watch a film that neither of us have ever seen, the much maligned 80s disaster flick. Give My Regards to Broad Street. So we're going to watch that with a couple of guests from series one who will be returning, which should be a fun evening. And we'll give you our cast a critical eye over one of the most infamously terrible films of the 1980s.
It can't be that bad, can it? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, like, it was definitely a bad period for that sort of thing. For some reason in my head, it sort of reminds me a little bit of, like, Moonwalker.
Ah, yeah.
The Michael Jackson, Joe Pesci thing.
Right.
Where there was a sort of post-MTV appetite for quite glossy music films or extended things. So
yeah,
we'll see if it's that bad.
What's your favourite bad film?
That's good. What, just of any?
Yeah.
It would probably be something that holds quite a lot of sort of nostalgic, maybe like Mallrats or something.
Oh, that's not
I watched
bad
it
film.
Back quite recently.
Oh,
it's not
dated.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
I really like Croupier with Clive Owen. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, yeah.
It's inadvertently hilarious. It's just nice. Very, very... It's quite pretentious.
Mm.
It's quite
He's
funny.
He's done his fair share of pretentious... I mean, he is in possibly the most pretentious film ever made.
What's that?
It's that horrible Patrick Marbury thing.
Oh, yeah.
we'll be back with Beatles books next week. And until then, have a lovely week.
Goodbye.
And keep beetling on. Oh, I'm tired.
That was really good. Beetling.
I thought it was about time we had a catchphrase.
Oh, that was very funny.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.